If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we are coming to you live from a couple of places on the internet. We are live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Instagram. Maybe you're listening later. Wherever you get your podcast, it's all good. And Justin, we got a packed show today, but I got a little thing to talk about first, if that's cool.
A thing.
Yeah, this sounds very ominous, but it's actually not. I mentioned it last week. This weekend, I'm going to be at Terrificon up in Connecticut, August 16th through 18th. We're going to be at table 1224. I think it's just going to be me solo, but we're going to be chatting with some great folks there and giving out some Comic Book Club swag. I just checked it today. I didn't want to promise it last week, but we have a lot of stickers, some buttons, some other things like that. So, Once again, if you're in Connecticut, if you're gambling at Mohegan Sun anyway, as I know pretty much everybody listening already is,
This is being broadcast on the floor at Mohegan Sun right now.
Oh, really?
That's where the fans go.
They don't allow clocks, but they do allow our podcast?
Yeah, we don't keep time.
We don't keep time, but it is 7.02 p.m. here in the East Coast, so let's get into it with our guests this evening, because we have some great ones. We are going to kick it off with a returning guest here. She is the creator of Lackadaisy Volume 2 from Iron Circus Comics. Just hit today, ladies and gentlemen, Tracy Butler. Tracy, welcome.
Hi. Hello. Good to be back.
Yes, yeah. Excited to have you back. Excited to have you on your book birthday. I always like to ask folks this when it's the book birthday. Have you been to the store yet? Have you scoped it out?
I actually haven't. No, I've been glued to my workstation here for days upon days, it feels like. I actually ordered the book online to just make sure it was going to ship and get here on time. You know, like the pre-orders were up for a while. I'm like, is this going to actually, you know, come through? So I did that instead. And,
and instead did it arrive? On, did you tell
did,
the Amazon guy?
Up. Yeah.
You're like, this is mine. I wrote this.
I didn't have a chance to do that, yeah, okay. But it feels good to, you know, be able to hold your book in your hand and be like, hey, it's a tangible object.
Speaking of that, though, so this is the second volume. The first volume, correct me if I'm wrong, came out in 2008, 2009, something
2009.
Like that.
Yeah, and that was the first edition of it a long, long time ago. And it had a fairly limited reach at that point. I was with a different publisher. It was a much smaller paperback book, but now we are printing them in glorious hardcover, much bigger, so the art can breathe and, you know, you can read the text effectively, and it's just, you know,
dream.
A level up, I feel
AKA
like.
So, the dream, yes.
Yeah.
And we actually got a comment here that I wanted to ask about before we even get to the book proper. This is from Scheuchler over here on YouTube. Says, Lackadaisy merch? Seems you have some in the background there.
Oh, yeah. There's a ton of it now. Ever since we released the cartoon, we've had people asking for plushes. So we made a bunch of plushes. Those are in the Lackadaisy shop. So, yeah, lackadaisyshop.com. You can find them.
Not to make you choose a child, do you have a favorite plush that is behind you right now?
It depends on the time of day and the mood I'm in, but I can really get behind Freckle as a plush. He's the orange one here. He's my video's mirrored, so yes. He's just kind of designed to be a plush. I think he's all round shapes, but in terms of vibe, I think Mordecai is kind of resting bitch face.
it's hard to not look, make hard eye contact with him. So yeah. That's a problem for me, yeah. Right?
He's just staring there, judgmentally
he's
out
glaring
there.
Glaring at
me. Well, let's talk about Lackadaisy. For anybody who isn't familiar, though I assume more people are familiar than they are with our podcast, probably. This is an incredibly popular, started as online comic, and has spun out into a multimedia empire. It is a historically based story set during the Prohibition where all the characters are, the large majority of the characters are cats.
They're
feline,
great.
Yeah. The feline. Love this book. Very involving, as we talked about, I think, the last time, but I'd love to hear you talk about more, particularly in reference to the second volume. It is so fascinating how much real history you're pulling on here. So talk us through the period and the different things you're dealing with in volume two.
Yeah. So, I mean, the 1920s, I mean, I think a lot of people are probably familiar with Prohibition, but I don't know how well known it is as a bizarre moment in American political history outside of the country. You know, if European readers and things maybe don't have that background in, like, you know, junior high school history class or something, where you learned about Prohibition and that time when alcohol was outlawed.
Seems insane to think that yeah, was a winning.
It does. It's, I mean, but then you look at politics today and it's like, wow, it sure is wacky out there. And I mean, there's honestly, there's some comfort in looking back to the past and going, oh, things were actually pretty bonkers then too. You know, and it's like just people just do weird things and political experiments come and go. And eventually you settle back into kind of a new normal. But at the point in time that this, you know, Prohibition was in effect, it was creating, you know, a thriving fertile ground for criminality. So, I mean, the booze became illegal to produce and to sell by and large. There were some exceptions, like, you know, sacramental wine and things, but that didn't quell the desire for alcohol among the people. So yeah. So it's just, you know, a big giant black market, and many criminals rose up to actual literal fame at that time, and they were popular figures. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of Al Capone, but there were multiple others operating in pretty much any city or any even small town in America, and pretty much every ethnic group, religious group, race was in on it, like had their own thing going. So it's just a really interesting point in history, and yeah, just a really, I don't know, ripe ground for telling stories about people who find themselves mixed up in this sort of business and the reasons they end up there, which are often not, you know, self-selected. They kind of just become desperate, and which is the case with these characters in this comic. Most of them are jazz musicians, in fact, and they kind of end up trying to carry the legacy of the patriarch of the crime family. Basically dies before the story even begins, and so they are left trying to shoulder this and figure out how themselves to be criminals for better or worse, and run this business and keep it, you know, afloat, so that they can continue to have a place to be and their jobs and livelihood and everything. So so yeah, it's just kind of an exploration of that sort of thing, and characters doing a somewhat bad job of running a speakeasy.
And and why cats then, I guess? All the history, all the research plus cats? Meets
yeah.
Cats.
I think they just make natural criminals. I mean, everybody posts pictures of their cats online and goes like, look at this criminal. What is this?
Yeah, what do they think?
No, it's like, I think we just, they're forgivable and likable despite being a little bit reprehensible. and so I think I saw a lot of that same thing in the, like, the gangsters of yore and the way they were romanticized and became part of, like, you know, American history lore. That same sort of likability and charisma mixed with, they're doing really questionable, morally gray, if not outright evil things. But we still like watching them do it for some reason. So I think that just, like, hooked up in my mind. Plus I like,
yeah.
Now, I don't know if this is very much skirting spoilers, and I don't know how much you want to talk about this since the book is just out today, but I really feel like you pushed the envelope in terms of what can happen in this world here. There are moments throughout this volume that kind of skirt on the supernatural, particularly as it further goes along. What led to that choice?
I'd say it's more magical realism in that you can interpret some supernatural element here, but you can also interpret it as, well, that actually could have happened and that could just be, you know, the way that it is. And I think a lot of the semi-supernatural things you see are happening are actually a session of basically cold reading going on between one character and another, where she's describing things about his, like, this character's past, and he's thinking of things, but he's making the connections himself. She's just saying things that are kind of like, you know, overtures and a little bit less specific detail. And he's filling in the blanks in the way that cold reading works. And so I think, like, I don't know, open to interpretation. And that's really the way I would like it to be. So if you want to interpret that as supernatural and this, like, sort of spiritualism is real thing, then you can do that. And if you want to say, actually, there's a perfectly logical explanation for this, that's cool too.
Oh, nice. Depends on who you are, I guess. We're seeing the art on the screen here. And just to talk about that a little bit, it has a simultaneously sort of a nostalgic sepia feel, but also sort of an ethereal dreamlike feel to it. Can you talk about, is that an intentional choice to get to those two things? Or
yeah, what? When I first started the comic, I really wanted it to kind of look like a hazy memory and maybe even a little bit of an unreliable one. There are some things in there that are a little bit more concrete in that they appear in the comic in the form of a photograph. And so it's like, okay, you could say this happened, but kind of everything in between that and the various photos that appear in here and the pieces of paper with writing on them, like, all of that could be just kind of a half remembered thing, you know, sentimental memory. And I think that's really where a lot of it came from. Of course, color started bleeding in halfway through the volume.
Actually, not to interrupt, but that's what I wanted to ask you about, bouncing off of Justin. I love how sort of shocking it is when you suddenly have these splashes or splash pages of color. What led to that choice?
I would love to say that this was just like some kind of artistic stroke of brilliance that I just incrementally introduced color after color, and it's just becoming more, you know, real as opposed to this thing of the past. But what actually the case was actually that I was finding the sepia tone rather limiting in terms of what I really wanted to communicate emotionally, and the fact that even just practically speaking, a lot of this takes place at night, this story. Because they're doing criminal things and to do it under the cover of dark makes sense, by and large. But sepia, when you're doing nighttime shots, looks very, very muddy and not especially appealing. And it's hard to make kind of like sepia brown look nice, you know, at night when it's just like everything is that color and it's dark. And so I thought maybe I introduce a little bit of blue here instead. Let's see what that feels like. And so I started doing that, and then I just couldn't stop introducing color. So I was like, all right, now it's just got a full array of color. But
I found it super effective, though, in the sort of bringing you out, sort of like waking up from a dream and like building in. It just makes it sharp. You sharpen your sense when a color pops in that way. So you're like sort of step back for a second and then lean in further, I felt.
Yeah, I feel like you really start to think about, like, well, what does this color mean or represent in this scenario? And how does the color make the scene feel as opposed to just everything being sepia? It's forced me to think a lot about color theory and how I want to use color and what it really means within the context of the story. It's just another tool for storytelling, really. So
I guess I don't know the timing on the creation of this necessarily, but was the color at all influenced by the fact that you also have the animated version?
No, the book was done, was completed before before the pilot. But certainly the doing the animation has had an impact on the way I look at the art and the way I draw the characters and things like that. Like my style up until then had been pretty strictly illustration like, where I do a lot of really like detailed wrinkles and folds and hair strands and you know, fur texture and patterns, and animation really forces you to look at the bigger picture of the overall form of the character. So I think I've just got better at using character silhouette to communicate something. And then, you know, letting whatever level of detail exists inside of that silhouette, you know, depending on whether I'm doing an illustration or whether I'm doing, you know, art for the animated series, like character design and things like that. It can vary, but I feel like it makes you like a stronger overall artist if you really are taking into consideration those limitations and working within those limitations, that, you know, you can't have an animator animating all of those wrinkles and folds and hair strands if they're doing traditional hand-drawn animation. You would kill them.
they would kill you.
And they would kill me too. Yeah, they would have every right to, honestly, to revolt. But
well, maybe this is sort of a wonky follow-up question, but when you say character silhouette, you mean like simplifying the form to make
it the overall form. So if you were to just fill in the character with a solid color and have nothing but the silhouette shape of it, you can still see the gesture. You can still see the character's defining features. They stand out from the other characters. You can get the character's mood and emotion just by the posture that's communicated through the silhouette. And so, yeah, it's just an element of character drawing that I think about a lot more now. I feel like when I'm doing, even if I'm going to take something to full illustration mode and really like detail it out, I think about like, what if this was just a solid color silhouette and just, or just even just do that, like in Photoshop or Clip or whatever, make a selection around the character, fill it in with the paint tool and go like, okay, does this pose actually still work even if I can't see any of the features or details? And does it communicate something? So, yeah.
Now about the animation, I think the last time we had you on, you had just launched the pilot, or the pilot had launched, and it, for anybody listening who doesn't know, enormously successful, so did really well. It's great. It's go to YouTube, check it out. And off of that, Iron Circus was planning on doing 5 episodes. Now you've started to put up episodes and minisodes. Where are we at in that season now?
So we had promised 5 episodes of about 10 minutes each to cover basically the first part of the story, and 3 mini episodes. We've done lots of little mini things as we were doing all of our pre-production for the season episodes. So we had to spend months doing like you know, visual development work, character design work, basically fleshing out everything we needed to make. Doing all that concept work. And while we were doing that, we were releasing tiny little vignettes and shorts, trying to get the animation team leads and cleanup leads and, you know, compositing team and everybody up to speed, ramped back up and, you know, accustomed to our new pipeline that we had. You know, we had fixed our pipeline in a lot of ways from what we had done on the pilot. We learned a lot of things. And so we have this new pipeline that we wanted to test out. So we made those little short things while we were also doing all of the visual development work and pre-production work and script writing. We had to do all the recording for the season, like the voice recording. Everybody had to head out to LA and record in studio for that. And that was a whole thing. Cool. So we've been very busy doing all of that. We released one of the mini episodes late in the spring, like toward the end of May, I think it was. And we are just busily, we've got some other little mini things coming up, mini animations, and we're busy working on episode one animation, rough animation right now. And it's in rough animation and cleanup phase. So it's coming along. It's just animation, you know, it takes a long time to make.
Time I think,
yeah, I think, you know, I didn't realize it before, but I don't think people who don't work in animation or maybe game design or adjacent fields know what the timeline is for a project like this and just how much labor is involved and how much time is involved, because you'll see something like Bob's Burgers come out with an episode every week for the season. And I think a lot of people maybe just get the impression that each week they just make an episode like during the week and then it's done. And it's like, no, they spend many, many, many months ahead of time making the whole season. Then they release each episode a week apart. So, so there is a big, like, you know, it's front loaded with tons of work.
Yeah.
Then you release.
But then, once that the big upfront time passes, then it all sort of comes. So that's exciting. I'm trying to think of what the, in the animation process, what is sort of the furthest from making and releasing a comic. And maybe it's recording the voice actors. What was it like to do that? Was that like sort of an out of body experience in some way?
Yeah. I mean, we had done it, we did it remotely for the pilot because COVID was raging at the time and nobody could be in the same place at the same time. So we had all of our voice actors recording from their homes. I think a couple of them went into studio to record kind of solo. But yeah, I mean, they were, some of them have recording booths at home that they made use of. Others had to basically go into their closet and kind of muffle, you know, insulate themselves in there and record that way.
Blanket over their head, the natural
exactly.
way to act.
Yes. Yeah.
In hiding.
I think at one point, Michael Kovach, who's the voice of Rocky, Rocky does a lot of maniacal laughing and things. And he was in the midst of moving to a new house, didn't have his recording booth set up. And so dead of summer, he had to go into his car in the garage and close the door and record Rocky's like screaming poetry inside of the car. And he was just like, buckets of sweat.
Oh,
they are really good. He
did.
Yes. Yes. They are really dedicated to their craft. Those voice actors. We love them. But yeah, that was really an amazing experience. But then getting to go and sit with them in a studio. We recorded at Melody Gun in Hollywood, and direct them, you know, through the window as they're in the recording booth, they can see us in the recording room. And getting to do that was really pretty surreal and like just very, very cool. But yeah, Dave Capdeville, Fable, the director, and I, all of us were giving the voice actors direction. We had done all the script writing for all of the episodes, and we just had a blast with that. Yeah, it was fun. Super fun. So,
and a couple, I want to say a couple of weeks ago, but at this point it was probably a couple of months ago, we had the folks setting up Iron Circus Games on, and we chatted about this a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
We kind of floated the idea of a lackadaisy game by them. Right now they're focusing on indie games, but is that something you would be interested in?
Yeah, I actually worked in the game industry for a long time while I was starting the comic. Like, it was a web comic back in the time when web comics were the laughing stock of the internet. I was also working in the game industry at that time. That was my day job. So I would be doing the comic art like in the wee hours of the morning, and during the day, I'd be working in games doing 3D modeling and animation and rigging and things. So, I feel like that would be kind of a natural fit for something like Lackadaisy. I could envision a few different ways in which it might work as a game. I'd love to be able to explore that at some point. Right now, I'm just trying to survive making a cartoon, though. That's taking up every shred of energy.
Sure, but just to mention, since we mentioned it here on the show, we get a producer credit on the game, I believe.
Absolutely, okay. Yes. Executive producers, totally.
Okay, great. All right, glad to hear it. So, just to sort of wrap up here a little bit, Lackadaisy Volume 2 is out now. Obviously, people should check out the pilot, and all the mini animations are fantastic as well. Anything else you want to plug before we let you go?
We actually just launched a new, we were talking about the merch before, but we had launched a new shop with the cooperation of Glitch Productions, who make Digital Circus and Murder Drones, Meta Runner. Like, they have been basically become a bastion of indie animation on the internet. Very, very well known on YouTube, obviously. Digital Circus has blown up in popularity to an incredible degree, and they are dedicated to basically trying to make indie animation a sustainable thing. And so they have launched a merchandising arm called Final Project, and we teamed up with them to make the Lackadaisy shop. So it kind of like all of that, everything we earn basically from selling merch goes right back into animation production. And so that becomes our financing engine, you know, as we go. We did a crowdfund that gave us the seed money to get started. And now we have that to kind of help us along. So LackadaisyShop.com. That's a cooperative thing between the Lackadaisy team, Iron Circus, and Glitch Productions Final Project. So check it out, I guess.
Get your plush and support the project.
There you go. Yeah, you can get the ebooks there too.
Tracy, congratulations on the new book. It's
Thank
great.
You.
We'll talk again in, I don't know, a couple of decades for volume 3, I guess.
Yeah. We'll have an art book coming out in November. So if you want to chat about that, we can do that.
Yes, please.
All right. That sounds better. That sounds
All right.
Good. Thanks,
sounds
Tracy.
Good.
Have a great
All right.
night.
Thanks, everyone.
Later.
All right, there we go. That was Tracy Butler. The book is called Lackadaisy Volume 2. It's from Iron Circus Comics. It's fantastic. If you weren't watching the show live, the art is stupendous. And the story is great, too. So there you go.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
Why don't we bring in our next guest? They are the creator of a new book from Archie Comics that is out tomorrow. It's a new/old comic per the use for Archie. It's bringing back an old property in a brand new way called Kardec the Mystic. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Butch Mappa and Joe Corallo. Hello. Welcome, guys.
Hey, hey.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, everyone.
Hi. Excited to have you here. Excited to talk about this book. We got a chance to read an advanced copy of this, and it is great. It is dark. If you're a fan of the Archie horror stuff, it maybe doesn't go quite as hardcore as like...
Yeah, it's not as horrifying. It's a great standalone story. If you, you know, feels like a Twilight Zone-y situation, I guess.
Yeah, this is something we've talked to a bunch of folks who have brought back the older Archie Comics properties for a new generation, is the big way of saying it. But what was the goal here? Like, what were you looking at with the old version of Kardec the Mystic? Joe, maybe I'll talk to you, but Butch, feel free to jump in as well. What was important when you were updating him?
Sure. With this, for me, this seemed like an opportunity to kind of be like, well, we can ride that line on these sort of Archie superhero books and that they've been doing, like Jaguar and also, you know, the horror stuff. I was thinking very much along the lines of, you know, like a 90s Vertigo kind of thing. Like I wanted to like kind of hit that point with it. And when it came to this story in particular, I had gone back and read a bunch of like the top notch comics, which Jamie at Archie, you know, sent over PDF. I was able to read quite a number of the old appearances, and was kind of able to cobble things together. And I was like, like the character of Lorna, for example, his fiance was, you know, prominent in a bunch of the early comics, and I was able to use her in this. Like, she seemed like a good character to have for it. Just really like figuring out where to piece some of it from, like the amulet and where it all starts from. There's some deep cuts, like if you've read some of the other Archie horror shorts and things like that, where some of the characters, like the old lady in the shop, you would recognize her from one of the stories, like things like that. I wanted to try to tie things together, and that's something that Archie likes doing too. So they were able to give suggestions and things like that when I was like, how can I tie this to something else? So they were like, do this. So I was like, okay. So that really helped with it.
Well, Butch, over to you then for the artistic perspective. You've got a character who has pre-existed in Archie. Archie has a very specific style. So what were you looking for here?
Well, okay, so the temptation and the thing that I thought about first when I got the assignment was to approach the artwork by doing something like an homage to like an old school, that kind of golden age or maybe silver age style of drawing. But then I realized maybe that's not the way to go, because we're trying to modernize Kardak for the newer audience. So for a split second, I thought about doing that kind of Sam Keith, kind of Bernie Wrightson, that style of artwork. Mm. And then I'm like, no, that's kind of not what we're doing here, or not what I want to do anyway. So I pivoted to something more modern. So I was like thinking, like you said, it's not like a horror, like an in your face monsters and gore kind of story. It's more a tense thriller kind of story. So that's where I looked at towards the artwork. I was like, oh, let's go maybe it's simpler, like let's focus more on lighting and shadow. And yeah, that was the artistic goal anyway for me.
For me, I feel like it has the vibe of a like a Justice League Dark, to bring it to like superhero stuff. Zatanna, Zatara, Doctor Strange story, like something that feels like it, but stands alone and is just a great sort of ride along on this character who is up against something and then has to figure it out.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, that's exactly the sort of thing we were going for. So it's good. Reads that way, so
yeah. And now, how much
convenient?
Convenient. That's what we always say. I have a panel here, a bullet catch, which was an old sort of very popular magic trick back in the day. Did you do a bunch of research on sort of these type of traveling magicians from the original?
Or did you watch that one scene in Deadpool and Wolverine, where Wolverine catches the bullet and then wrote from there?
Either is equally valid.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, it would have been helpful if that movie was out before I had to hand the script in. But but no, it's I did do some deep diving. I watched, I looked at some older stuff, but I also watch, you know, clips from, you know, like your Chris Angels and all that stuff too. Like,
Mind Freak.
You know, I like
check out the Mind Freak. I'm like,
you know, it was like watch what was it? Remember that video years ago where Harrison Ford was shocked that there was like money in his orange? Like, I'm like, you know, maybe there's something to learn from that. So
that's really funny.
You know, but yeah, and I also have to give credit to Jamie, who's one of the editors involved as well, for that first opening page, because in the initial draft, it was gonna sort of like be a little more linear and just open. He's a struggling magician, and things happen, and she was like, "What if we started with like a splash sort of thing, and then we go back and do that?" And I was like, "Great," and that. And I did a little research, and I was like, bullet catch, we're doing that. That's going to be a good opening page. So
that's really nice. It sets the tone so well.
Yeah. The thing that I think is so interesting about this is that Kardec has, I don't know if this is spoiling too much, but has one very specific power that he plays with. Like, he's not necessarily Doctor Strange, where he's all magic all the time and I can do literally anything. He could do one thing. And then uses that to tear his magic out. What is that limitation like? Like, what does that free you up in a certain way? Because you're challenged just to figure out ways to iterate this, or how did it affect the writing process?
Yeah, I mean, I like sort of putting those challenges, you know, there, and then just having to deal with them. So I kind of really honed in, and they even sort of asked as I was putting it together, like, does he do other things too? Like, because I always feel like with a lot of these things, if you go too much too fast, like, where's the room for anything else to happen sort of with the character? And, I feel like doing something like this and like kind of lead, like know, like maybe there is the possibility it could do more. Maybe this amulet can do, but it's like we can save that later, you know, like more things can come, you know, later. So there's room for the character to, you know, sort of go somewhere potentially. So I kind of wanted to pull it back, restrain it a bit, focus, like, because it's also really a story about this, you know, relationship he has with Lorna. And I wanted to really make that relationship the sort of thing where it's like, I mean, they're together. I guess they love each other. I don't know. Like, they like each other enough. Like, and,
yeah.
You know, something that felt like a bit grounded and sad, and maybe there's something there, maybe there isn't. Like, so that was a lot of fun for me to work on that. And then just having this sort of, having a guy who's at this sort of like low point and gets like any kind of little bit of power and is suddenly like, oh, hey, you know, top of the world kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, imagine how crazy things would have gotten if he got like a lot of power all at once. It probably would have gone horribly.
Judging by the movie The Prestige, you only really need one trick to do magic.
Yeah. That's true. I did see that in theaters. Wow. You know, I enjoyed that movie quite a bit, but yeah, it's I didn't really pull from that too much. So, you know.
Yeah.
That's all right. Butch, I had an art question for you, and I don't know if this was you or not, but just looking at the pages right now, they're pretty heavily inked, which very much emphasizes the shadow. Was that from you? Was that from the inker? Where did that come from?
Oh, well, I did the inks, I guess.
Oh, okay.
I work digitally, so the virtual inks, I guess. So, I just wanted to give a sense of, like I said, like based on the story, I wanted that creeping sense of dread, because that's kind of what we're going with for Kardak here. That mood and darkness. So and the way the story was told, actually, like I was like, oh, this is perfect. Like the story literally has lots of scenes with heavy lighting because of the nature of the story, with the stage and the audience. And then outside, it's always like night scenes, the way Joe wrote it. So it was like perfect. Like I don't even need to fake any lighting. So all the lighting was just organic to the story.
Well, what about the power effects? Because you have people becoming transparent when that happens. Is that a challenge to draw? Because you're essentially penciling one person over another person.
Yeah. So I wanted to figure out how to do it in a different way, of course, how to show Kardak's invisibility power, I guess. And obviously the obvious way would have been just to draw another figure, have Ellie, our wonderful colorist, color it, and then just put it on a separate layer and then fade her out. But I thought, okay, so maybe, I mean, it's a horror book, right? So let's do something a little bit more gritty, I guess is the word. So my initial design actually was, my initial concept was like he would fade, like dissolve almost. He would almost like dissolve into invisibility. Like his clothes would dissolve, and then you'd see a little bit of his flesh that would dissolve. So you'd see a little bit of the muscle and the skeleton, like a little bit of a scarier version of invisibility. But it was a little bit too confusing and maybe a little tougher to execute. So I was like, oh, let's just simplify. Let's just do the top layer dissolving away. And it looks like, I don't know, it looks like they do that sometimes in movies, like when characters magically transform into, like, for example, like a flock of ravens or something like that. So that's kind of what I was thinking. So I just, there's some technical stuff that I had to work out. And Ellie did such a wonderful job putting her colors over it. Because in my head, it was like, he's black into gray into invisibility, but she put like this ghostly green effect over it, over that sequence. And I was like, oh, that looks so good without being too fancy or too like the style that she did still fit the line work or the art that I was kind of had in my head.
Well, and what I would say on that is it reminds me of like practical effects in classic horror movies. And I think that to me really,
right,
it has a nice alignment with sort of this updated version of an older Archie character. It all comes together in the sort of content and art in a really nice package, I felt like. So whether that was intentional or not, it really is a unified vision, I feel like. It's really nice.
We got a question here for Joe from the comments on YouTube. Joe, are you going to L.I. Who? Wow.
I am going to be at that show on the Saturday of the show. I'm on a panel sort of discussing like licensed comics.
Is this Long Island Doctor Who? Is that what it is? Okay.
Yep. Way to read the tea leaves.
Long Island Doctor Who show. Yeah. And fun fact, Ken Deep, who runs that, he was my store manager when I worked at like Hollywood Video like 20 years ago. So
wow,
you know, it's all full circle. I mean, I guess I'm still working for him in a.
Yeah. What are you gonna do when you get there to Long Island Who? And he's like, restock the bottom shelves, Joe.
Yeah.
We need Con Air. We need Armageddon. Get it on there.
Look Who's Talking To is not totally moving. Not. Get that in people's bags.
People keep asking for Bruce Almighty. Like, that stuff. It's, what a weird thing. Hilarious. We had way too many copies of Men in Black 2. Way too many copies when that came out. That was... I don't know if this is a hot take or not, but like it wasn't as good as the first one.
Whoa. Wow, wrong show for risky. That, Joe.
Yeah, how dare you?
This is a Men in Black 2 house.
We've always
first
said
and
that.
Foremost.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be such a flex to have the full wall of one video. And mm-hmm. So I guess that may be the move on MIB2.
Yeah.
Here come the Men in Black, I always say. Absolutely. But also one of the Men in Black is Kardak the Mystic because he's wearing a suit. Nice. Now, the issue comes out tomorrow, and per Archie's usual, it seems to be a one-shot. But do you have any thoughts for more? I'm always very curious about the strategy here, because I know they're spinning a bunch of the properties into the cursed library thing and bashing them up there. But is there any talk about continuing this, or is this really just, we got this one tale, we're telling it, we'll see what happens?
You know, I don't want to do that, but... there's definitely room to do more stuff. And I would love to see more happen. I feel like, and this is true for most companies, if you buy a lot of these comics, it makes them just go like, I guess we have to do more. I suggest getting them to sell out. So then they're like, hey, Joe, money, you like writing comics and drawing comics and doing these here. What if you did it again? And maybe this time it's going to be three. We'll see. But if the demand definitely goes, I'd like to do with Kardak and Lorna and some of these other characters.
Awesome. We got a question here for you, Butch, from Facebook. Being from the Philippines, was wondering who did Mr. Mappa look up to as an artist when he was younger?
When I was younger, Wills Portacio, of Wetworks fame, of course, like growing up. Wetworks, got Wetworks rocking over here.
Wow, you and then, practice what you preach.
I know, right? And then Lionel Yu, of course, another legend, of course. And then outside of the Philippines, I mean, you don't even have to go outside of the Philippines to find artistic idols. There's so many from Kardak's time even, right? Outside, I guess, one of my strongest influences is Stuart Immonen. He's like the artist. He's so versatile, and that's kind of what I would like to have happen with my artwork. Yeah, probably he's probably one of the biggest ones.
Awesome. Well, listen, guys, thank you so much for coming on. Love the book. Fingers crossed we're going to get that three shot in the future. We'll see what happens.
Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's great.
Thank you.
Joe, Butch, thank you for coming on. Have a great night.
Good night, guys.
Thanks for having us.
All right. There we go. Once again, the book is called Kardak the Mystic. It's out tomorrow from Archie Comics, unless you're listening to it tomorrow, in which case it's today.
There it's in your go. Hand. Look yeah. down. It's in your hand.
Magic. Ah, boo. Good
That's
trick.
The prestige. The third part of prestige is the book's in your hand already. Good night.
Well, thank you for explaining that so well, Justin, because our next guest is one of the people behind Manga-splaining. That was really a horrible good. Transition. I'm really sorry to everybody who's listening. Ladies and gentlemen, Christopher Woodrow Butcher, welcome to the show. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming. Ooh, excited. Oh, you are muted, I think.
Somehow.
Maybe we're having problems. Oh, no.
Maybe log out and log back in real quick. And,
yes.
Select your mic and we will talk.
Yes, we will talk extemporaneously. We'll manga-splain things to each other. Oh, you're back. Hello.
There we go. I think I'm back.
There it is.
Yay.
Yes.
StreamYard decided it did not like my input and chose a different for me.
StreamYard does that.
Sorry about that.
No, it's fine. Listen, we all started using these streaming prop forums around, 2019, 2020, and it's been 4 to 5 years. And they just haven't figured it out yet.
They
have literally not at all.
Every time I sign in, StreamYard is like, I'm going to select your cell phone camera as the one you want. I'm like, nope, that's in my pocket, you psychopath.
We don't use StreamYard. When we do manga-splaining, we do the manga-splaining podcast, we use a different site called Riverside, which is like, it saves all the streams and stuff separately so they can edit it. David, who does the podcast with us, can edit together after the fact, right? And like adjust all of our levels and whatnot, because we don't do anything live. This is actually terrifying. I don't know how you guys do this every week.
it's the opposite for me. This is a little peek behind the curtain for our listeners. It is exhausting to me to edit all the streams together. So I'm like,
let's just press publish.
And we're good.
Yeah. I get that from David too. He edit our first episode next season. Oh, sorry. David's on the podcast, David Brothers, and he's also decided he wanted to edit it. He wanted to learn how to edit. And it's kind of biting him in the ass because our first episode of the year is an hour and a half after editing. It went for like 2 hours. We were just, we hadn't talked to each other for 4 months. And we're just like, yep. Let's talk about this book that we covered. So yeah, it's exhausting. I totally feel you, Alex.
All right. Well, I should do better, I think, is the main
takeaway.
Look at
this insider podcast chat. Really
oh, shit. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, it's fine.
Get a bunch of podcasters together. They're going to talk.
Yeah, people mostly tune in to us for editing tips on podcasts. And we're usually very bad at it, so this is a step up. You guys do so much stuff. You've got the Manga-splaining podcast. You've got the Manga-splaining Substack. One of the main things that we're here to talk about, though, is you have a partnership with Fantagraphics. You've just put out Search and Destroy by Atsushi Kaneko.
Kaneko is correct. Yeah, good job.
Excellent. It is going to go rapidly downhill, but it's a reimagining of Tezuka's Dororo.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Okay. First time for anything, I guess.
Shocking.
And so the way that you've been doing this, correct me if I'm wrong, but like you had the podcast, you started syndicating manga on the blog, and now you're working on getting some of that published as well. Is that kind of the broad
overview? That's basically that's the very short astute version of it. Good job. We're doing the Manga Slating podcast. We actually just hit 100 episodes last season, which is nothing compared to you guys and your 250 plus. Congratulations.
Again, do not edit anything, so
I have no memory of even one of those besides this current one.
Well, great. I'm glad to be here for the good one then. Speaking of which, the Lackadaisy art and Butch Mappa's art on that last book are both gorgeous. I was so shocked. I haven't seen comic book art in a little while, so totally lovely. We started doing the podcast, and then Substack arrived on the scene, and Chip was one of the early creators, Chip Starsky, who's writing Batman right now, just finished up on Daredevil last year, was one of the early creators. And he's like, hey, do you guys have any manga in your lineup for these like original projects you're doing? And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, Mangasplaining. So we came up with the idea of Mangasplaining Extra. And unfortunately, David couldn't work on it because for his day job, he works for Viz, which is like the biggest manga publisher that there is. So we had to figure out like how to set up a firewall between what we're doing. And so it didn't get David in trouble. But yeah, myself and my partner, Andrew, and Deb Alki, who works on the show with us, started figuring out like if we could publish. Like, we talk a lot about, you know, the comics that we read on the podcast, the manga that we read on the podcast. And it's like, man, you'll come across something, you'll really love it. You know, you'll be like, why isn't anyone as excited about this as I am? Why isn't anyone publishing this in English? Like we love it, right? And we just we got this opportunity with a little bit of seed money. And we're like, well, shit, let's just publish all the stuff that we've always wanted to publish that no one else has taken a chance on, even when we've like pushed it on them. So the secret of Mangasplaining Extra is every single book in the line is something that either myself or Deb had pitched to an existing manga publisher, and for whatever reason, they couldn't make it work. And so now we came back around and was like, all right, let's do it ourselves. And so far, it's just been the most fun, honestly, getting to like bring these creators like Kaneko Sensei to North America for the first time, and for the books to be so warmly received. The book came out at San Diego, so I guess a couple weeks ago now, and the reviews have been just awesome, like so positive and phenomenal. People really getting what we're doing.
So jumping back a little bit for the podcast, Mangasplaining is you're sort of bringing manga to the people. You're getting it at like what are give us that, because it feels like you've made a big creative step. But where did you start?
Mangasplaining is a podcast for manga for people who don't know manga podcast or people who don't know much about manga. It is three manga experts, myself, David Brothers, and Deb Aoki, and we are educating, mangasplaining to manga newbie who doesn't know anything about manga, Chip Zdarsky. He knows all about the superhero comics and the Vertigo comics and the graphic novels and the whatnot. And he was always just like, we actually took him to Japan. The four of us went to Japan with Nick Dragota, actually, who just signed on to do the new Batman book. And we're in Japan and we're all like huge manga nerds and we're bringing him around. And he's having like an existential crisis the whole time. Cause he's like, first off, how is this industry that's this big that I didn't really know much about? And secondly, how is there this much stuff? Like, we took him to two different museums dedicated to the same manga creator. that were like trying to picture that, like, and it's the guy who came up with Power Rangers, Shotaro Ishinomori, who came up with the things that came up with Power Rangers and Kamen Rider and stuff. And he's just like, I'd never even heard of this guy. And he's got two different museums dedicated to him. Plus, they preserved his childhood home, so it's kind of three museums. Like,
yeah. I mean, that's fucked up. Do you feel like him. Are those museums coordinating with each other? Because like, that's
or are they fighting? Rivalry. Are they fighting? Yeah.
They all keep one really important thing from the others, so everyone has to visit all three.
that can never touch, right? Like,
yeah. The three items. They're together. Not allowed to make a replica of his work desk in the one museum because the real work desk is in the other museum. So if you want to go and see like the Kirby, you know, like the Kirby or the Ditko drawing board where he did all of his work, right? That's in one museum. But if you want to see like a thing dedicated to his creations and characters, that's in another museum. And if you want to see what he was reading at 16, they've preserved his bookcase behind plexiglass.
Yeah.
It's
not
great.
To poke holes in your premise here or anything like
that.
But Chip is the manga newbie. You took him to Japan. You've done 100 episodes. Is he still the newbie or like?
Yeah,
he's really.
Is he that dense?
He's really good now. He's actually like not a newbie anymore. And we had kind of a crisis where he's like, I don't know if we should be doing this with me anymore because I know too much about manga now. We need people to come in and ask really dumb questions. And I'm like, we've got a list of people that we'll eventually have guest episodes with. But I think season five is going to be the last like traditional season before we start bringing in more guests and the people that want to learn about manga But yeah, Chip has really been, he's such a, I don't want to give away the game, but he is incredibly thoughtful comics creator, yeah. Incredibly thoughtful writer and persona. And when we give him a book, regardless of if it's a serious book or just the silliest, dopiest thing that we could come up with that week, he goes all in. Like, mm-hmm. he commits to reading it, engaging it on its merits, and maybe loving it, maybe hating it, but he's still he's game for it. And that's actually the best part about the podcast, is that all of us, even when we don't like something, and I tend to be the most aggressive in my dislike of certain books, there's respect there, because we all know how hard it is to make comics, to make anything, you know what I mean? So you don't go all in and say it's worthless. You just go and be like, it is not for me. And, you know, for all the stuff that's not for him, he's found some of his favorite comics now are manga that he's encountered through the podcast, which is absolutely amazing. Really, really cool.
Now, this sounds like it is not an issue, but I'm going to ask about it anyway. Given that your podcast is very positive, it's about lifting up manga, but I'm trying to think about it from the perspective of, like, we have a comic book review podcast. If we suddenly started being like, great, we're releasing comic books, there might be a little bit of a conflict of interest there, because we're trying to sell our comics at the same time as we're doing it. Is that part of the discussion, or is it different because of the different tone of your podcast?
It was something that we had, actually. It was a discussion that we had pretty early on. And not even before we started doing the stuff with Mangasplaining Extra and working with Fantagraphics and Udon and stuff. David has a full-time job working for one of the publishers whose manga we review and discuss on the podcast. Deb does consulting work for like half of the manga industry. Deb's a force of nature. And she's heading up the first manga awards that are taking place at Anime NYC in a couple weeks. And I'm doing consulting and marketing for like a bunch of publishers as well. So like, we're all deeply compromised. Like, there's no getting around it. And we're pretty clear about that up front. But I think I can't even think of any exceptions. No one's been upset about any of the coverage of the manga they've gotten, even when we haven't liked a book. Like, I could still think of books that I've read that I'm like, you can't pay me. Like, you would have to pay me at least $100 to set aside the hour to read volume two of something that we read on the podcast. But I still didn't talk, like, I still didn't treat it like shit. Like, it's honestly, it's hard to make comics. It's hard to put 22 pages of something out, let alone 200, let alone a series.
Right.
And at the end of the day, you have to realize that, like, this is, not only was this published in Japan in multiple volumes, but an editor in North America looked at it and went, yeah, there's something here. Someone's going to really like this. And they brought it over and they published it here, and it's got fans. And so you have to keep your ego in check. You have to keep your critical reviewer ego in check and just go, man, this just isn't for me. And here's why I think it doesn't work. But as often as we say that on the podcast, someone up will be like, that's why it works for me. It's so stupid that I love it. Like, you know, yeah. that kind of thing. So yeah, I think criticism is, I think that there's degrees of criticism, and I understand why people engage the way they did. I used to do that more or less full time, actually. But yeah, now it's just looking at work and being like, you can only work with so many creators for so long before you realize that, like, there's no real joy in crushing somebody's dreams that's trying to make comics. Be encouraging,
well,
be supportive. Yeah, it's all work.
It's all
right?
Work. Like, so it's like, it's yeah, not you can like be like, eh, being a jerk.
Didn't work, wasn't for me. Yeah. Good luck on the next one, is like the worst I want to say about something.
Yeah. Now, can you mangasplain a little bit to us?
Sure.
With we've been in the comics game for many, many years as far as reading superhero comics and any of sort of mainstream US comics. But and so we've got a lot of like manga recs, but like, is there anything sort of new or a new rec of something old or something that you
can I bounce off of that a little bit? Because I was thinking along the same lines for the next question. Justin, we've been doing this show for a while. We have similar thoughts about this thing. So just to bounce off of that, we do get the question all the time on the show, where should I start in comics, right? And I assume you get, where should we start in manga? Like Justin's saying, we've read some manga, but my follow-up question always, whenever anybody asks me what comic should I start with, is what do you like? What are you interested in? So I can kind of focus it a little more. So I'll throw out at you one of our favorite, actually, Justin, not to speak for you, but one of our slightly older favorite books and one of our current favorite books in mainstream comics. We love Lock and Key, which was a horror comic book. And currently we're super into Ice Cream Man, another horror comic book. So knowing those two things, what's potentially a manga that you might recommend? Well, is that
fair? I like that. I asked a question. Give you a second to think, Christopher. But like, I asked a question. You're like, I will make that question much harder.
I don't know. I think. Hopefully it's easier, but maybe it's harder.
Ice Cream Man is the Joe Casey book. No, it's
sort of like an existential horror book. So either like this or horror
mythology. But existential horror, loosely connected. Yeah.
Okay.
So one of the books that we covered on the podcast that was a favorite that David recommended actually is called Ajin, A-J-I-N. It got an anime as well. And it was weird because the first volume was a little bit wonky. About halfway through the book, the artist fired the writer and moved the series in a different direction entirely. And so it's an interesting book to read. If you're like a comics person, you're going to see the exact page that everything changes. Like you're going to open up the next chapter and be like, whoa. And it's the same artist. He's just like no longer constrained by what the writer wanted to do. But it is an existential horror that is really compelling and really well drawn and really interesting that you're reading it and you're like, okay, I kind of get it. And then it just shifts into gear halfway through the first volume and does not let up. It was one of those ones where it's like, read Ajin volume one. And I ended up reading the first three volumes because I was so hooked on the series and where it was going. So it's a young kid coming home from school, maybe like 16, 17, walking with his friends. He pushes his friend out of the way when he sees a truck coming and ends up getting hit by the truck himself. And then he stands up and he's still alive and he realizes that he's not human and never has been. And he's actually something else. And it, you think it's going to go in a superhero direction? It does not. It goes in a very dark direction. And there's people around. There's people with cell phones. There's people with cameras and they see this happen. And all of a sudden he's just like, I got to get out of here. Like I got to whatever. And he goes on the run and it turns out he's a demi-human. And the more times he dies, the more of his humanity he loses. So people are chasing him and trying to kill him. So it's this existential body horror of him not being who he is, where he is both hunted and trying to be saved by other people like him for reasons that he doesn't understand. And it's a little bit fugitive-y. It's a little bit like my body isn't my own, like, and I'm trapped in this shell. And then the art is fantastic. So I would say try Ajin Demi-Human. It's a very good horror book, but honestly, the low hanging fruit answer is the many works of Junji Ito. You will find something to love. Junji Ito is like the horror mangaka. Viz is publishing everything he's done, I think, at this point. Literally everything except for like the one book that Kodansha got or the two books that Kodansha got. And you kind of can't go wrong. They're all short story collections. We kind of love everything he's done. We covered one of his books on the podcast and it was like, yeah, it's not his best book, but it's still like an 8.5 out of 10. Like you kind of can't go wrong with any of the Junji Ito short story horror collections. There'll be something in there that you'd be like, oh, I never considered that. And now I'll never stop thinking about it. And that's what's good about horror.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's talk about Search and Destroy because as you mentioned, that is relatively recently out. So what's the pitch for this book? What's the concept?
So it starts from a place of being an adaptation of an Osamu Tezuka manga. He's the guy who created the god of manga in Japan. He created Astro Boy, which is his best known work, which was also adapted into Pluto. It was another adaptation of one of his works. You guys might have read Pluto. It's a great book. Yeah, got an anime on Netflix last year, this year. You don't need to have read Dororo or even Tezuka to really understand what's going on here. It is a cyberpunk future in which you're introduced to a young woman with lots of cybernetic arms and limbs, and she is chasing down people, robots, creatures is what we call them in the book. I'm trying to figure out how much to give away and how much not to give away, and murdering them to reclaim, here, this is a creature, to reclaim the parts of her body that have been stolen by them. And so it is about body horror. It is about women's bodies and who has domain over them. It is about being a you know, cool girl with cybernetic legs and giant metal blades for arms that just murders gross gross creatures in lots of different ways. There's incredible violence. There's incredible social commentary and artwork that I think would really appeal to people who think that they don't like manga artwork. It doesn't really look like what you would consider traditional manga art. Atsushi Kaneko, who's the creator of the series, is a lot more influenced by North American artists like Charles Burns and Dan Clowes and like Rat Fink and stuff like that, like creators like that, than he is other mangaka. And so you that's his head just being sliced clean off and sliding to the side. God, I love Phil's letters on that. It is a book that I think is really timely when you're talking about autonomy and living in a world that is controlled by some not so great people. So I think if, well, I mean, the book's called Search or Destroy. If you're a pop fan, if you're a punk fan, this, there's going to be a lot in here that's going to resonate with you, I think.
Now, can you talk a little bit about, specific to this, going from the sort of reviewing side to the creation side? You sort of talked about it on the reviewing side, but what was it like in sort of being close to the creation of something like this?
So I've actually gotten to meet, if you talk to a lot of any manga editors, they'll say it's really, really rare to actually get to talk to the people who make the manga. It's usually a licensing process, and you might talk to like a licensing agent or a lawyer or something at one point. But I'd actually gotten to do karaoke with Kaneko Sensei in Japan before I actually ever approached him about publishing the book.
What better ways are to connect with this person?
I did one of the songs from American Idiot by Green Day, and I feel like I passed his coolness test. Wow. So when I met him the second time, he's like, yeah, all right. But he did, I can't remember what song it was, but it was like, I feel like it was like Vamps or something. Anyway,
what's
regardless.
Pussycat? Just
he is a subculture dude. And so in that case, it was like, I had known about his work for a long time, and I actually worked for Viz Media for a little while, and I pitched his work there, and everyone's like, yeah, it's great, but it doesn't really fit what we're doing. Like, we're the Shonen, you know, they're the Shonen Jump company. They're doing a lot of really beautiful shoujo titles. This kind of like artsy seinen whatever just wasn't their vibe, you know? And it's too bad. But you know, that's fine. Like, everyone gets to be a publisher and decide what they want to publish, and that's kind of cool. So when the time came, I knew that Kaneko Sensei was someone that I wanted to see published in English, because I thought he was just an undiscovered gem, that because he didn't look like manga publishers wouldn't pick him up. And that's the same thing as I reviewed this book for consideration for publishing, the same thing I would review a book, same way I would review a book if it had been presented to me to comment on, you know? It's like, is this going to work? And it's like, yeah, his style is interesting and commercial. The title's awesome. It's got that Tezuka connection. But more importantly, the story's really good, really, really good. And it has a lot to say, and it's incredibly timely. And so when we licensed it, we sort of let it slip within the industry that we had gotten it, because there's a lot of people who are Kaneko fans, but he's never been published. Right. So we were approached by the translator, Ben Applegate. And he's like, I heard you got a Kaneko book. I've been a fan of his forever. What book is it? And it's like, oh, we're doing Search and Destroy. He's like, I translated the first volume of that for fun. I've actually just got the translation. Can I be the translator? And I was like, yeah, no problem. That's wild. Anyway, he's an amazing, he did a great job. And then same thing with the letter. I approached the letterer, Phil Christie. I'm like, hey, I really want to work with you. You were amazing on this other project we sort of worked on together. And he's like, I'm totally full. I can't do it. I'm like, it's Kaneko. We're doing Search and Destroy. He's like, ah, fuck. All right, let's do it. Like you can't. That was his favorite manga creator of all time. Ben's one of Ben's favorite manga creators. And it's just like, that's awesome. Actually, yeah. To
gratifying.
Find people
You're
who
like,
are as
I think we made the right choice.
About it. It's like, we all know this guy's great, right? Like, let's bring him to English. And in doing that, as soon as we started publishing it online, we got contacted by a guy who's been banging the drum for Kaneko in France, in Europe, actually. So he actually, we commissioned him to do the introduction to the volume. His name's Federico Anzalone. And he did a an introduction, which he called Pretty Hate Machine, which I think is pretty funny. And it is about Hyaku, the lead character, as a pretty machine filled with hate and rage, which I think is pretty good, actually, as well. But it, yeah, it brings up a lot of the context for the creator that we've been talking about here. So if you're coming in fresh, there's a great introduction. You'll kind of get where Kaneko's coming from, where this story's coming from.
Communities tend to be very insular, as I'm sure you know. Has there, since you are an American podcast publishing manga for the American audience, has there been any circling the wagons, any issues there? Or I mean, it sounds like you know, pretty open.
We are half Canadian, sir.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Wow. What an insult.
I am what an insult.
And actually, I don't even live in North America.
No, as you say in Canada, I'm sorry.
Nice.
Apology accepted, bro. I think what we're doing is a manga podcast that is for people discovering manga. So it's clearly squarely aimed away from the manga community. Like, you know, anyone in the manga industry, anyone in the manga community doesn't need us to explain Goodnight Poon Poon by Inio Asano to them, because they've all read it. Like, they've all read it. Every once in a while we'll do like a sort of a left field pick, and that'll bring some people in who it's like, oh, this is my favorite mangaka, no one ever talks about them, that's how I discovered your podcast, actually. Like, that's kind of cool, right? So yeah, I think no circling of the wagons. I think the fact that we're pretty respectful towards all manga helps a lot.
That? What were you?
I did talk a huge amount of shit about light novels in season two, just went off. Light novels are Japanese originating, for the most part, short novels that use anime tropes and characters to sort of create these super easy reading novels that are mostly serialized online, sometimes straight to print, for people to read on their phones and things like that. They're rarely well written. They're usually not great. But the thing that I didn't take into account, and I apologized for later, is they offer a way to break into the industry of writing that is actually unparalleled. Right. We don't have anything. It's sort of like if Archive of Our Own or any of the online fan like writing websites actually had a funnel towards getting published in print and getting paid for your work in a very different way. Sort of, you know, it started a long time before, but Kindle is doing a lot of that, like Kindle Singles and Originals are doing some of that stuff now. Wattpad is doing some of that stuff now. This is all a Japanese model. Manga we're fairly respectful about, but I didn't give them light novels their due, and it is a way for like people who are disenfranchised to actually get writing and put their work in front of people and get feedback and get published. And I would love to see more of that. I think we had a guest on this episode with Lackadaisy, where that was someone who just believed in what they were doing and put their comics up online and, you know, found an amazing audience and tremendous success. Couldn't be happier for them. So that's really cool.
Awesome. Before we let you go, what else is coming up? So you have Search and Destroy. The second volume, I believe, is coming out mid-2025. Is that correct?
That's the plan, I think.
Okay.
I think we're shooting for spring. Let's say spring. But this was spring and it slipped. Search and Destroy is available now in better comic book stores everywhere and online and wherever you guys get comic books. It really is tremendous. You can also read it at mangaexplainingextra.com or mangaexplaining.substack.com, I think. And that's the digital version. But the book, Fantagraphics did a nice version. I mean, French flaps, nice. Come on. This is good stuff.
Love the flaps.
The French flaps are good. Our first book with Fantagraphics was actually this chonker, which is called Okinawa by Susumu Higa. And it's a complete change of pace. It's a nonfiction memoir, historical fiction memoir of times during the war on Okinawa in World War II, and then contemporary situation with U.S. military bases on the island of Okinawa in Japan. Very different, but really wonderful, tremendous response to this book as well. I'm really, really proud of it. Lots of awards, which is lovely. And our next book is not... both of those were serialized on MongoExplainingExtra.com, but our next book, due to licensing kerfuffles, could not be serialized, and it's called Gigatown, A Guide to Manga Iconography. And it has a real nice quote. Scott McCloud was really kind to us. Gigatown is the Rosetta Stone of manga iconography, a delightful gift to comic scholars everywhere. Scott McCloud, Understanding Comics. Thank you, Scott.
Nice.
So yeah, like if you need an endorsement, but what that actually means is, you know, it's the ultimate manga splaining book, and it's coming out in September. So you know all the little like manga doodads that are attached to characters, like you know, smoke coming out of their head, or spirals, or little hearts, or whatnot. Sorry, this is reversed. Or the like plus sign on their head when they get angry. This explains what all of those manga icons are in comics form. So everything from we show like the movement lines and then a four-panel comic strip and an explanation of how they work. So it's comics.
That's cool.
It explains what manga is, and it's a guide to iconography. Yeah, it is manga explaining the book, basically. So
that's so awesome.
Yeah, we're excited about it. It's another nonfiction book, and then the book after that will be Search and Destroy 2, and then after that will be Wandering Cat's Cage, which is Japanese take on Southeast Asian version of Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. So we're facilitating wildly.
You're pendulum swinging.
Yeah, vacillating. And then after that, it's a full color romance book, manga that we're doing called Veil, which is beautiful, actually. And then after that, it's an autobiography of someone who was a manga assistant while they were still in high school, sort of like Jim Shooter on Legion of Superheroes, but with shoujo manga. And that'll come out hopefully by the end of 2025. So yeah, Search and Destroy is out now. Gigatown's out in 2 weeks, first week of August, actually, or first week of September. Sorry.
Awesome. This is so cool. Christopher, congratulations on everything. I can't wait to read every single bit of this. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much. I look forward to your publishing line, guys. What are you gonna?
I know.
What are you gonna publish first? Who's dramatically underpublished according to you? If I can turn the questions around,
us ourselves.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're gonna publish a guide on how to edit podcasts. It's very short. It's basically a leaflet.
More of a pamphlet. Yeah.
Live to air, just live to air and no editing. Perfect.
That's the title. Live to air. Editing guide.
Come on. Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. Have a great night.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Later.
There we go. Once again, the podcast is called Mangasplaining. The Substack, also Mangasplaining, and MSX, Mangasplaining from Fantagraphics. You can check out all that stuff, including Search and Destroy, which sounds awesome. First volume is out now. Second volume coming out next year. Check that all out.
Please.
And folks, we are
going to... says cocktail ash can. Let's go.
Oh, well, actually, hold on. We did do that. I'll bring that up in 1 second. But why don't we move to our next section, which is my favorite section because you all make it up. It's your audience questions. Oh, I forgot to put the volume up. There we go. Live edit.
Live
edit. Magical.
Not live to tape.
Yes, it is. For audience questions, all you got to do is drop your questions in Facebook, YouTube. I got to take that X Twitter out there because they don't do that anymore. And Twitch, you can also do it on Instagram. Here, I'm going to run over. I know I mentioned we're going to Terrificon. Now, here, I'll finish what I'm saying first. Now, at Baltimore Comic Con, I put together a little book, an ash can of cocktail recipes that Brett Macris, real chef from New Orleans, currently at Wild South, put together based on comic books that we drink every week. People loved it. It was a big hit. So here, hold on. I'm going to grab, if I can.
Ooh, this is good. This is dramatic. Alex is doing a classic prestige reveal of the
So at Terrificon, I'm going to put together a second volume of Brett's recipes. We're going to have it limited to 100 copies of the ash can less. Because, not to spoil it, I'm going to send out a bunch to our Patreon supporters.
Yeah.
But it has a bunch of the recipes that he did. I'll show off one here. We got the Yo Joe based on G.I. Joe. We got
to watch out. See, someone is going to get their hands on this.
Oh, my God. No, I'm going to do it. I'll shake it so they can't do it. Yeah. Chemical X based on Powerpuff Girls that we showed off to Kelly Thompson and Polina Ganeshao and a couple of others there. So if you find me at the table over at the con, I will have copies of that. And we had a couple of leftover ones from the Baltimore con that I will still have on sale.
Complete
as well.
The collection.
Yeah, the recipe is legitimately great cocktails. So yeah. I can't take credit for those.
They don't go bad.
They don't.
Still fresh.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So please check that out. What are you drinking tonight, Justin?
I had another smooth margarita, which is like
my
margarita with my grapefruit peel infused tequila and Italicus bergamot liqueur mixed in. I really like it. It just gives it like an ease as you're drinking it. Really
nice. And I'm just having an old fashioned. That's it for me.
But look at your fancy glass.
I do. Yeah, look at that. All right, we got a couple of questions here, so why don't we get into them? This is from All in the Game over on YouTube. Hey, fellas, D23 was the definition of sequels, reboots, and remakes. Anything grab your attention?
I mean, just their naked commitment to it, I guess, is one thing. When I saw, is it Incredibles 3 they announced?
Yeah.
I was like, what, guys? Okay. Yeah.
I don't know, man. I mean, listen, here's the thing, not to be all corporate about it, but everybody was like, they learned the wrong lesson from Inside Out 2. The main lesson there was they released a movie called Inside Out 2 and is the most successful movie they've done in a very long time.
And it was good. That's what I'm saying. Like, if they can make sequels that are good, good. Yes. That's great. I have no problem with that. I think, though, a healthy company is doing sequels and building out all of their properties, but also doing some originals.
Yes. And I think they had one, they had Hoppers, which is their beaver brain switching comedy, which is like, sure. What did you think? I'm very curious to hear your take on this. Have you watched the trailer for Star Wars Skeleton Crew?
Yes. And you know, it does keep working on me. So just a little backstory. I watched Rebels with my kids. So I'm rewatching Ahsoka with them. And they're like, what's happening? But then I explain it and they're like, this is cool. And I'm like, is it cool? So it's definitely working on me. So like when I saw Skeleton Crew, I'm like, yeah, man, I'm in. And we haven't watched Bad Batch yet because we're watching. Mm-hmm. Now it's a family thing. So I'm excited to get to Bad Batch.
I am still so thrown by them literally just having suburbs at the beginning of that Skeleton Crew trailer.
I think that's better, though. That's better than doing the same nonsense thing.
I don't know. Everybody keeps springing up. They're like, there's precedent. There was a 50s diner in Attack of the Clones. And I'm like, but we hated that. What are you talking about? That's not a good defense.
But here's the thing. I just like variety. Like in Ahsoka that I'm just rewatching, literally, like, they go to a planet and there's one spot on the planet that stuff happens. And it's a planet. I'm like, you know what? I don't think
that's Star Wars. They're like, where are we going? Oh, the ice planet. Oh, let's now go to the jungle planet. You know.
But it all made sense in the original because it was like, the base is there. Oh, and Tatooine is nothing except for this little bunch of little shit. There's these vapor farmers and the bar. So it's like, yeah, it makes sense.
I guess. I don't know. There's something about the pure representation of it that totally threw me. But at the same time, well-paced trailer, funny, exciting. I'm just, God, I hope nobody I know shows up, because that was the thing, like, to spoil the end of The Acolyte. I was like, please don't show me anybody I know. I don't need this. I just give me, for 1 second, a story that has no Skywalkers in it whatsoever, and I'll be a happy man.
Plus, I also want to be like, that's what you need to do. Help us help you by trying something that doesn't just be like, hey, look who's here. This uncle you heard about.
It's Uncle Owen. He's back. You love him.
Yeah.
The Agatha
All Jawa that was there. Remember the Jawa you love?
Yeah, I don't, though. I don't. Please don't. The Agatha All Along trailer I thought was great as well. Love that. Very fun. Very into that show.
Is it going to be good? Now the hype is building. Yeah. Now the hype is building. Ah, this is a show that I was like, it felt like the last, like, let's do something weird. And it was like, they can't even.
It's got a good structure. I mean, what they set up in the trailer, for anybody who hasn't watched it, is Agatha's got to get her power back. She goes on the witch's road. So I think... I'm totally blanking on his name. The actor who's playing, not Billy Kaplan, quote, quote, is Joe Locke. He said that each episode is going to be a different horror parody, essentially. So they're going to do like an Exorcist. They're going to do clearly Wizard of Oz and other stuff. Great. I'm all in. Sing some songs. It'll be fun. The one thing that was very weird to me, though, was other than the stuff that they had already announced dates for, nothing had dates. There were no announcements. They had an entire animation panel. They were like, look at this. We have four animated shows. When are they coming out? I'll never tell.
Well, as we learned earlier on in this very podcast, animation takes time. And I bet they're going to start to jockey them based on both scheduling and interest.
Okay, well, what about Ironheart? They showed off a trailer there that I believe was the same trailer that they showed off 2 years ago, if I remember correctly, and did not give a date for that.
I have a bad feeling that Ironheart is a worse Echo. Like, it's something they're going to end up being like, yeah, remember how it was 8? It's now 2. And we released them 3 months ago. Surprise!
We backdated them on Disney Plus
or something. And I feel bad. I'm excited for that show.
Yeah. For sure. I hope it works. Dominic Thorne is great. Anthony Ramos.
All of the signs are flashing red. This is not
for sure. All right. Well, that was a very negative things that grabbed our attention. Why don't we move on to Darren? Tupot says, if a creator is accused of using AI art or scripts, does that taint the whole project? Or could you separate the art from the AI and appreciate the writing, even if the art was AI generated or vice versa? I'll just say, yes, it does taint the project and they shouldn't be using AI, period.
100%. And I'll give you a personal example of the first time I was working on a job earlier this summer. I was working as a writer, rewriting a show that was being made, and they were aggressive schedule. They wanted to pay me very little, and they were like, "Here's the scripts we have," and it was clearly AI generated. I was like, "Guys, no, I will do it. When you do this, it makes my work three times harder because I have to go back through, fix all the AI, and then I have to fix it so it's good." And you don't know how it's just so wrong. It's so wrongheaded. Everyone's like, look, I did it all. I did a day's work. And like, yeah, you set yourself back a day is what you did because now it's all wrong. And in so many, any time I've encountered AI, I was working on a shoot just 2 weeks ago. And they were like, I AI generated this letter from this corporation that they're going to read on camera. And they read it. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense. They can't read it. We have to fix it. I'm like, guys, so yes, it taints it, and it doesn't taint it from like just the fact that it's AI. It taints it because it's wrong, it's instantly inauthentic, and it's just a bad choice. Take the time and write it, you psychos.
Absolutely. It's not easier. It's not cutting corners or anything like that. It's just bad. It's theft. It is stealing things from other things. I just don't understand how we can't get through this level of like, one of the first things we learn is do not steal.
Yeah.
And that they're like, well, what if we steal a little bit? That's fine.
Well, right? This is such a heated topic for me. And I feel like I'm still in the minority on it where I'm like, yes, it's a theft machine. It's it's something that like legally there's no standing. This stuff has to, all of the AIs were trained on not their property. Yeah. I can't believe Hollywood has not sued the shit out of all of these AI companies. They just don't understand it yet. I think they will. And I think it's going to change the industry. Also, have you noticed that the whole AI industry, despite all the crazy NVIDIA investment and shit, they still haven't found a way to apply this that works?
Not at all.
Google's like, oh, everyone hates this?
It's awful. It's terrible. I think I mentioned this on the podcast, but not just me, but I'll use me as an example. I remember I was searching for something. And the first result was Google's AI result, where it was actually about Riverdale, and they were like describing something about Riverdale, and I was like, that seems very familiar. I scrolled down directly below. It was an article I had written word for word that they had put in their Google AI result, and I was like, who is this helping? This is not helping anybody that you just stole the words that I wrote that are right below it. It's insane, and I'm far from the only person. One other thing that I'll throw around is that, like, I've been looking for jobs, and half of the jobs are AI trainer is people that are looking for. I'm like, why would I do that? Why in a million years would I ever do that job? Be like, great, let me just write a bunch of stuff that you can steal from me and then never hire me again. Insane.
Yeah, that's some like 1950s Kurt Vonnegut shit. Player Piano, if you've ever read it. That's like, hey, train your robot replacement. Good luck. And it's like, that's crazy. Our brains are broken.
Anyway, nothing against you, Darren. Hope that was all right.
No knock. But I will say, to answer your question very directly, yes, it taints the product. And yes, it taints my observation of the product.
Same here. And in terms of comics as well, I mean, if we're specifically talking about that, I'm trying to think of what it was. Oh, this is what I was putting, not to spoil another recipe, but when I was putting together this recipe book, I put our Space Ghost recipe in there, and I like to put the covers and credit the artist. I realized the cover was credited to Francesco Mattina, who was accused of AI use on the DC covers, and I was like, can't use that. Yeah. I don't know if it's AI. I don't know if he stole it. So there you go.
I don't want to keep talking about this, but we don't like cheaters in our world. And when someone's out as a cheater, no, it still counts as cheating, and everyone's going to be mad about that.
Yeah. Schreckler says, should I see this Borderlands movie? All the reviews have been so good. Yes, absolutely. Buy as many tickets as possible. We have to support original properties like Borderlands. Thank you,
Schreckler. Wow. Is that an AI Alex that just answered that question? Pretty much.
Yes. Schreckler obviously is joking. That movie is clearly bad. It's been wild to see people be like, it's not just bad, it is devoid of literally anything that makes a movie. As soon as I heard all of the negative vitriol about this movie, I was like, somebody in 5 years would be like, Borderlands is good, actually, and here's why.
Yeah. I mean, yes, for sure. It'll be an AI-written article. I do think that the trailer shows you what the movie is. It's like, I don't know what's happening in the trailer. It feels like someone did a clone of Guardians. Turning to the galaxy.
Just to mention, for anybody who is going to pick up a copy of Comic Book Club Cocktail Book, Little Book of Comic Book Cocktails, number 2 or number 1, Straight Bullet says, I'll sign any if anyone wants them signed, which is very nice. Nelson Kelso says, have you guys checked out Tales from the TMNT? Thoughts if so? I have not, but I'm excited to check that out. That is a spinoff of the recent Mutant Mayhem movie, which was great, like very funny, very enjoyable. I have not had a chance to watch the show yet, but I definitely want to.
Same but will.
Yes. And we got one last one here from All in the Game Watch. Any of the Olympics thoughts on Tom Cruise in the closing ceremony?
I did watch some Olympics. I wish I had watched more. I watched some fencing. I watched some gymnastics. I watched some just straight up weightlifting, which was cool. Some martial arts randomly.
The only thing I turned on, my favorite competition is breakdancing, and I turned it on for that. Watched the Australian, and that's the only thing I got to see, and it was beautiful.
And you cheered aggressively. I mean, I will say Ray Gunn, I believe is the breakdancer's name, has really turned it into a like, see, I am bad, but I celebrate myself. It's like, oh, okay, strong take. And as far as Tom Cruise goes, I think it's a cool idea, the passing it off to LA, which is doing the 2028 Olympics. Love that idea. But when I saw the headlines, I was like, what is this little scamp up to now? Parachuting into the Olympics? He shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
But he seemed like he's having fun. And if he wants to risk his life to show up to any sporting event, let's go.
Yeah. And then I saw, I think it was Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg were doing some sort of performance at Santa Monica or something like that at the end there. I didn't have the sound on. I assume it was California Loving they were performing.
Wow. Nice. That's probably true. I love how so much of the Olympics is like, look at these celebrities who are there, and they are having fun.
What a good time. Cast of Superman was there. Good for them.
Makes sense.
Yes.
Superman's all about athletic achievement.
Exactly. And folks, that's it for your audience questions. Before we wrap up here, why don't we talk about what's coming out this week that we're looking forward to? There's so much. Justin, are you ready? You ready to throw some picks out there?
I mean, there is a lot of stuff, and boy, do we have a action-packed stack for you coming up so soon. I guess there's a bunch of stuff. Sensational She-Hulk's coming to a close tomorrow, and man, I love that comic. It's a bittersweet to see what they have in store for the final issue. I am excited to read it, but a little bit sad. I also am excited. Profane number 3 is coming out, which is Peter Milligan's book, which is a sort of detective. It very much reminds me of some of Matt Kint's recent work, but it's a fun, a little more leaning on the action side of it. So I would recommend that as well. And number one rec, though, Houses of the Unholy, the new Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips book that's coming out. I mean, if you are reading comics, you should be reading this comic. Just more very personal, deep dive crime / bad choices by characters.
100% on that. And on the Matt Kint bend, very excited for Guilt Frame number 1 from Dark Horse Comics. Matt Kint, when he was on the show a couple of months ago, talked about this. This is the book that he wrote with his mom, Margie Kint, Kraft Kint, and it's a new mystery book. I think I could probably say that it's great, so you should probably check it out. Mm. Also, very curious, we checked this out before, but Kill All Immortals number 2 from Dark Horse Comics. We had Zach Kaplan on the show as well. That's very cool. And yeah, I think you picked the rest of the stuff that I wanted to throw out.
No, Alex, I would never steal.
Oh my God. I'll throw out never DC, AI you. DC versus Vampires World War V. We love DC versus Vampires. So excited to see what
blood hunt continues.
The blood hunt begins again. And folks, that is it for this week's show. Couple of people we want to thank. We want to thank Tracy Butler for coming on. Check out Lackadaisy Volume 2 from Iron Circus Comics. Joe Corallo and Butch Mappa, Kardak the Mystic, is out tomorrow from Archie Comics. Very Christopher Woodrow Butcher, check out Manga Splaining, as well as MSX Manga Splaining Extra from Fantagraphics with Search and Destroy. And next week on the show, Hannah Klein and Lisa Sterl are going to be here to talk about the new graphic novel Dying Inside. And Elliot Rahal is going to be here to talk about The Cursed Library, also from Archie Comics. A couple of other things. Check out Comic Book Club News, our comic book podcast that posts Monday through Friday every morning with comic book news per the name. Patreon.com/comicbookclub. Support the show and all the shows we do. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice. At Comic Book Live on Twitter/X. Comic Book Club Live on Instagram and TikTok. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, good night.
Good night, folks. See you next.
They sit on crappy couches and they let us.